Blog Talk Radio. peaceful and quiet river, God's gentle voice divine. Trusting in you I go forward, leaving all doubt far behind. Peaceful and quiet river, flowing through heart and mind, source of my courage and wisdom, you taught my spirit to fly. Flow, river, flow, soothing my soul. Flow, river, flow, onward you go. Quiet river, sing me your song of life, music that dances within me, painting the darkness with light. Peaceful and quiet river, you are my special friend. You're always there when I need you, faithful and true to the end. Flow, river, flow, soothing my soul. Flow, river, flow, flowing through heart and mind, source of my courage and wisdom, you taught my spirit to fly beyond the sky, beyond the sky.
welcome to another edition of Continue Mission. I'm your host, James McCormick, and we've got Richard Kilblaine, and we've got Father Michael Pacella on the line as well. And we have an open mic night tonight. Every now and then we have those and star brains. And to allow us to just kind of let the spirit of the radio show take over. Now, as you know, some of these, we've been on this radio show for a long time. And all of you listeners, whether you're listening to a recorded version, you know, sometimes it gets a little bit lively in here. And we have a lot of fun. I like the music. Every now and then I like to grab some time just to unwind and relax my brain as well. When you look at everything that we have going on in our life, you know, life is complicated. We see things going on with the COVID-19. It's not gone. It's not going anywhere, okay? It's going to be with us for a while. I think that, you know, whether your beliefs are for or against the vaccination, you know, definitely I think we can all agree we got to do something. We got to do something. Because a lot of people are getting sick, and I mean, it's serious sickness. It's not just, like a cold. Now, some people go through this thing relatively unscathed. They get something like a real bad cold or a flu, and in some cases, they think it's like a form of allergies. I mean, I have talked to people that have had COVID, and their COVID symptoms were very mild. Then I know others, you know, they were intubated. They were, you know, put into a coma, a medically induced coma, so that they could get through this thing. And some did not get through it. Some very young, healthy people have died from it. So it is kind of a scary thing for people. But we're supposed to not be afraid, right? You know, I mean, there's a... you know, I always cleave to a Bible verse in the book of Joshua 1:9. You know, when we talk about don't be afraid, don't be terrified, because God's with us wherever we go, right? But if you remember in the New Testament, you remember the walking in the wilderness with Jesus. And what happened, did he say, when the devil, you know, came and told him to jump off of this mountaintop and that the angels would come and rescue you. Jesus said that it's not wise to tempt the Lord our God. So we need to take precautions. Don't tempt God. You know, not that you don't depend on him, but you don't just challenge it and say, well, I'm going to not do this. I'm not going to wash my hands. I'm not going to wear a mask. I'm going to cough in people's faces. I'm going to do whatever I want to do and not take any kind of precautions that were given under good advice. You know, you wouldn't run in front of a train that you were going to be plucked away at the last second. So we should take precautions. We should be smart about this. Use our brain. God gave us a brain. Let's utilize it. Don't be afraid, you know. And there's something about cleanliness too, being next to godliness. So hopefully, you know, we'll be able to get through this and through this show, and I hope that everyone can hear me okay. Yeah, there may be we have some storms that came through here, and hope that it hasn't caused any issues. So I'm going to pull on Shella and Richard Kilblaine, and we're going to have a discussion, and we're just going to let this radio show go the way it needs to go. Actually, some of these radio shows actually turn out to be pretty good. So if you got any questions, call in. So let's bring in, hey, Father Michael, you on? Can you hear me? Anybody hear me?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, there we go. There we go. So am I breaking up some? Because we have a little bit of a storm surge
yes.
going through here.
Yes, you are. Okay. You're breaking up some. I text you that. I tell you, my son sent me an article from The Atlantic from his former commander, who retired in 2019 as a colonel.
Mm-hmm.
And the article's called What We Got Wrong in Afghanistan, and very enlightening. And, you know, he commanded combat units in Germany, Kosovo, Kuwait, Iraq, and Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Colonel Mike Jason. And I thought we might talk a little bit. I know my son's quite upset, quite infuriated, and that's not really like him because of what's happening there, because of what they did. But I found this article very interesting. I sent a copy to both you and Rich. But I guess some of the training, in his opinion, was not sufficient, nor were we really qualified as far as some of the police force type of training. And I know it's really on the hearts of a lot of people, you know, what's going on and what's happening with the withdrawal. I was just wondering, what were some of your thoughts?
Well, I'll tell you, I fielded calls most of the day today because, as you know, I've been elected as the national commander of the Military Order of the Purple Heart. And you know, with that position, you become the, you know, a lot of people call you, not just members, but people from, you know, congressional offices and everything. Mm. So I've been asked about this thing. And so as a young boy, and I wasn't too awful young, but I was young enough, I was watching the fall of Saigon with my father, you know, on mm-hmm. television. And that helicopter, you know, obviously there were many helicopters in and out, and, you know, it was chaos in the weeks up to the final departure. But there was something about that final departure that really broke many spirits and broke many hearts.
Mm-hmm.
And I mm-hmm. think, you know, what's sad is that the reality is we won every battle. We won the war. We accomplished the mission that we had, kill bin Laden, you know, and eliminate those that perpetrated the attacks on 9/11. We killed them and many more. And in addition, what you will find with the Taliban or with anybody else is they're not going to go toe-to-toe, you know, with, you know, even 3,000 troops. They won't even go toe-to-toe with mm-hmm. with 300 troops. But what they will do is they'll lay back, they'll hide, they'll take some pop shots, and then once we're gone, they'll just come out of the woodwork and they'll go back to doing what they were doing. What's going on with the, you know, them closing on the embassy? You know, that's terrible. You know, they're capturing, you know, equipment that we had left, you know, for the Afghan army. We've been there for 20 years, you know.
Yes.
There have been people, their entire military career has been centered around this war. You know, it ate up a lot of my life. It ate up some of my son's lives. It definitely eats up a lot of my, you know, my dreams at times sometimes and my memories. Of course, I didn't serve in Afghanistan. I served in Iraq. And,
right.
You know, but I was always, you know, I felt this same way whenever, you know, ISIS was moving through and just taking territory. And I was like, good goodness, you know, we had been to these places and, it was hard to believe, you know, that they'd gained so much momentum. But what I had to really look at with that and what I look at with this today is, we're not there now. You know, we gave Afghanistan, you know, 20 years. Now, whether or not that 20 years was adequate training, whether or not we failed them, you know, I think we're failing, you know, the interpreters and the people that assisted us. I know that many of them have been slaughtered, you know, by these zealots. that are in the Taliban. And many more will be, unfortunately, because it seems like America has made a tradition of abandoning their allies. Mm. You know, that's a hard thing for me to say because, you know, I love my country. I'd go fight and would give my life for it to get into this day. But I do not agree, you know, with pulling pitch and leaving, you know, without a better plan. Now, what is the better plan? The better plan, you know, would have been an agreement with, you know, multinations that would have established a level of peace, you know, in that region. If anybody really cares, every member of the UN cares about human rights as they say they do, then they could see that an organization, a group like the Taliban, who absolutely has zero respect, you know, for human rights, come in and they will absolutely, if they really cared about that, they would come in and they would put forth an effort to, you know, gain some security and then really train these people, you know, like you were talking about, the police forces that weren't trained.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, you can't take it. You know, I used to patrol streets in Iraq and go up and down the roads. If somebody was doing something wrong, at one time, if they wore a certain style clothing, we could have shot them, you know, and got away with it. Well, that's not that way when you're dealing with the local population. You know, you have to understand, you know, we see, you know, a need. The police officers should be training these folks, people that have interaction with the local population.
Commander said was we weren't trained as an army to train police forces.
Yeah.
And the few that they brought in, officers, didn't have the capacity like a national police force. So he's
right.
Just trying to point out some of the inadequacies as we, you know, reflect on it. I mean, he's not being negative. I mean, he served in so many capacities. But before we enter something again, you know, we always do an after action report, right? We're trying, what did we do right? What did we not do right? And that kind of thing. So I found it very interesting. Mm-hmm. And certainly we're all patriots. We love our country. We want evil not to persist. And we want to stand with people. You know, I was part of a task force in Vietnam, 71 and 72. And, you know, there was quite a perception when we came back from the culture. And I just wonder how some of these Afghani soldiers are going to have to, like my son, deal with the same thing that I did when I was in college. And I didn't see any of the level of action that my son did.
Well, you know, it is interesting that you bring that up. And it just, you know, for me, when I look at, you know, my mission was very defined. Protect convoys. And look, when the command came in, it was nothing personal with me. You know, people say, you know, killing people and people trying to kill you is pretty personal, but it really wasn't. Mm. It was about a job. So you came in and I had a commander says, you take convoy A from this point to this point, and you bring them back, and you bring them all back alive. You know, that's your mission. So whatever prevents you from performing that mission, you eliminate it, you know, for a lack of better terms. And sometimes it could be a bad truck driver, you know, that wasn't doing what they were supposed to be doing. And, you know, we dealt with them as well as we dealt with the enemy. But the goal, ultimate goal, was to do that. Now, when you are dealing with a third country, now, I was stationed at Fort Benning, so I worked with the School of Americas from time to time, so I'm familiar with that, you know, with that type of training. So when you think about that on the scale of training a police force or a, you know, even a military force, you know, ultimately, you need qualified people to do that. And probably the best case scenario would have been to train the Afghan army to be able to stop what's, you know, to be able to stop what's going on now. Obviously, equipment doesn't make a difference. Yeah.
That's what he said. Could I read a little bit from the article?
Yeah, please do. Absolutely. Yeah.
He says, if those were things we did poorly or insufficiently, there were other things we should not have done at all, namely train police. We generally accepted that our ultimate goal of combating insurgents or terrorists was to turn the fight over to domestic law enforcement. In other words, get to the point where the police could handle threats without fielding the army. And this is in parenthesis. I remember in Iraq, 2006 was supposed to be, quote unquote, year of the police. It would be hilarious if not for the incredible cost in blood and treasure. That year was a terrible and deadly one for police across Iraq. But the United States does not have a national police force, so police training became a task that largely fell to the Army. In Iraq, I oversaw thousands of police, and in Afghanistan, I led a task force that vetted, selected, and fielded nearly 3,000 local police while supporting the Afghan National Police with warrant-based targeting of insurgents. I should make clear that I have zero law enforcement experience, nor does most of the U.S. military, aside from some National Guard or Reserve troops. He says, we do have military police units, but they serve a unique operational role, unlike any of the security forces we tried to build up. So he said, we attempted to bridge this gap by hiring a handful of brave and retired police officers and having them serve as technical advisors and trainers alongside U.S. Army troops. But even they could only focus on tactical tasks. They lacked the professional and personal experience to build national institutions and systems. We never had a chance to make policing work. The U.S. military could not overcome our national and institutional lack of experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, that's the difference. You know, we should have been, you know, I mean, not dealing with, you know, when you're dealing with the police force, then you're dealing with and each one of those tribes are different, you know, I mean, and it was the same way in Iraq. You go into a Sunni controlled area, it was different than a Shia controlled area. And, and what you needed was a group of people that were skilled in, you know, law enforcement in a very, you know, diverse Muslim culture. I mean, let's just face it. I mean, there was, you know, there was a lot of things that they did different there that we thought was very strange and bizarre, but it worked for them. And, but now training an army to defeat an enemy, now that we should have done a better job at. And I don't know if it required us to gain protection, but let me tell you where I think that the big downfall started on. Why the Army of Afghanistan is folding, because they've seen exactly what the Americans have done with the interpreters and the people that assisted us. We didn't just jump in and pull them out and support them. So they saw, hey, look, you know, if we fight against the Taliban and we lose, the Americans are not going to come save us. We're going to die. So probably best thing to do is lay your weapon down and go back home. And they have a high desertion rate, you know, which, you know, that's understandable. You know, I mean, it's like they don't want to go and, you know, fight and think that they're going to have support when support's not going to come. So I think that's another blame on us. And they watched us do it in Vietnam with the Montagnards. They watched us do it with the South Vietnamese. They watched us do it, you know, in Iraq, the first go around with the Shiites and the Kurds after we left Iraq, first Desert Storm. I remember that. I felt ashamed you know, leaving, and watching, you know, the Iraqi army, who we had, you know, essentially defanged, you know, pretty bad, you know, but anything above this certain corridor, you know, they were still pretty powerful, and they were going and they were taking it to the very people that had helped us, you know, defeat Saddam's army. And I think you watch that happen, you know, in other places as well. Now, I think that Iraq now is in a better position than Afghanistan. I do believe that there was, you know, something else is working there. There was an establishment of, and I know we're not supposed to build governments, but we did kind of help build that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a better option than what we've got going on right now in Afghanistan. Afghanistan, totally different beast. And again, like I said, you know, I remember watching that as a child with my father, first time I ever seen my father cry.
Mm.
And I watched a tear go down his cheek, you know, and him, like many others, were saying, you know, it's just a big waste of our time. You know, all my friends were killed, and, you know, my father was in the 173rd Airborne at Dock Toe Hill.
Mm.
You know, if mm-hmm. you ever read the story about, you know, the battle for Dock Toe, and the number of casualties, you know, from that battle. And, you know, I mean, you'll understand what I say when I say that, you know, he felt this was very personal.
Absolutely.
And it hurt him.
I have an acquaintance that was in 3rd Brigade and during the Tet Offensive. He's a neighbor. And he walks the neighborhood. He's a Christian man, a praying man. And I happen to have a Vietnam cap on one day. Where'd you get that? You know, and he hadn't had one. And I was able to give him one of mine and talked a little bit about what he did. And certainly there's a great stake. And I think that's why my son is feeling infuriated. Now, this article is certainly balanced, and he gives a lot of credit for all that he feels our soldiers did. But like any good leader, you have to do an after-action report and see, you know, what we could do better. And now, you know, we're at this place with the embassy, as you mentioned, and I think they deployed, what, 3,000 Marines?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just think that for those in the future, you know, he said instead of there being a 20-year war in the article, he said it was like 20 different one-year wars. So there seemed to be a discontinuity,
mm-hmm.
you know, in our overall planning. And anybody can be, you know, a Monday morning, you know, quarterback, you know, sitting in their chairs.
Sure.
And I understand all the pressures that the generals faced and all the different situations, even that my son related to me.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to learn from our experiences. As much as we can love our country, we can be a little bit of a person who gives a critique so that we can at least not be blinded in thinking that we did everything right. And I think I see a patriot who wrote this article, but yet, you know, he was in the fray many, many years. And my son spoke highly of him because he was his commander when he was there. And I think he was a lieutenant colonel at the time. And now, you know, he retired as a full bird colonel. And so I appreciate, you know, the balance of the article. And I just think that, you know, we have to be somewhat self-deprecating and we have to learn. And, you know, reflect as we do. Otherwise, we become cynical. And, you know, I know what happened after Vietnam and the way I was treated. People had no idea what my function was, but they just looked at it in a certain way. As a matter of fact, I had a good conversation with someone who had been at Woodstock, and, you know, I was in Vietnam. And I don't really think that the culture or the society took the moral high ground. I think there was a lot of breakdown in our culture, and it really impacted us. And I'm just concerned in how this is going to impact the great men and women, our soldiers of Afghanistan, with this whole withdrawal, and even those from Iraq. Your thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think that there's going to be a price that's paid for this for many years. And, if I was sitting in the seat of the president or the secretary of defense or, definitely, I would be thinking about that. And obviously, we've become so politicized. Everything is, let me just think of the proper terminology when I want to say this. They're galvanized with one thing. I mean, every news report that I saw today really didn't give a crap about the ultimate withdrawal from Afghanistan. Every news agency today was jockeying for a position to either slam Joe Biden or slam Donald mm-hmm. Trump or to slam the Republicans. Or slam the Democrats, and they could care less about the soldiers. I'm going to just tell you that right now. So if there is a media source that's down here, and all you Americans that are listening to this, understand, you need to be an American first. And these media, trolls or whatever you want to call them that are out there that are blasting these stories out saying, oh, my God, it's a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing. It is a terrible thing. And we should be demanding as citizens that it not be done this way. However, it has been now to the point to where, we're not really talking about solutions. We're talking about elections. And I'm telling you right now, everything, if 3,000 of 3,000 troops got killed in this fiasco, okay, in this battle, if 3,000 people got killed, the majority of your news reports and the people that are out there jockeying in D.C. that are representing you right now, America, they're going to look to see how they can jockey that to get them votes. They're not worried about the parents that are crying. I'm just saying that. I'm just telling you, the majority of them, not all, but the majority of them do not care about the end result of control. And that's the problem that I see more than anything else. Because
we're both military and professionals. If I could, I'd like to read the last paragraph of what he wrote. He says, we didn't fight a 20-year war in Afghanistan. We fought 20 incoherent wars, 1 year at a time, without a sense of direction. The U.S. military mm-hmm. can and should be blamed for the collapse of security forces in Afghanistan. I hold us responsible. The current collapse keeps me up at night. In the military, the main effort gets the best resources and the best talent available. For more than 20 years, no matter what was reported, we read in the headlines, efforts to build and train large-scale conventional security forces in Afghanistan and Iraq have mostly been an aimless, ham-fisted acronym soup of trial and error that never became the true main effort, and we are to blame for that. But we are not the only ones responsible. Someday we will ask young men and women to do this again. To fight a war overseas, to partner with local forces, to train them and build them up. Before we do, we owe it to those young people to ask the tough questions of how and why we all failed. And again, this is Mike Jason, retired in 2019 as a U.S. Army colonel. After 24 years on active duty, he commanded combat units in Germany, Kosovo, Kuwait, Iraq, and Afghanistan. And as I told you, he was my son's commander when he was there.
Because we have been in the military, we accept responsibility. And that's something that mm-hmm. that is in short supply people accepting responsibility. Now I'm in positions of authority and leadership right now, and there have been things that have happened, especially in the civilian sector, where I'll say, you know, totally my fault, I own it, and people look at me like I'm shocked, like they're shocked. They're like, you know, because they're used to people trying to jockey away from a position of responsibility. And so I appreciate what he's saying. Now let's get to the meat of what he's saying. What he is saying is that essentially what we have said many times before, that we have to go in to fight wars with very clear, concise objectives and an exit strategy. An exit strategy that includes, you know, either leaving a follow-on force, a coalition of nations that have agreed forward and to help with security, or, you know, you have to, you know, be prepared to stay in it for the long haul. No one can deny that we were in it for the long haul in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. We've been there for 20 years. Although I will argue this until the day that I die, that the bloodiest battles occurred around in Iraq and cost us quite more in blood, but not treasure. And for that reason, you know, I have to look at, you know, exactly what he's saying about the lack of direction. Not because we didn't lose as many in Afghanistan, even though we were there much longer than we were in Iraq, but because what were the goals that were accomplished? I've never ran into a commander or a soldier that did not have the sense that we defeated the enemy soundly in every battle, no doubt. You know, our mission was, you know, kill bin Laden, or honestly, it was just to take out you know, those that performed, you know, the atrocities on 9/11, and we did that. Killed them by the scores, like I said earlier. So at that point in time, you know, we should have decided, well, mission really is over. We've completed our mission. A lot of people went really south and sour on President Bush when he talked about mission complete. But he was talking about, you know, the removal of the dictator Saddam Hussein, and that was a complete mission. And they hung him. You know, not the Americans didn't hang him; the Iraqi people hung him.
Right.
And they have an assembly of a government. It's not perfect, by no means, but I do think that they have a little better control, obviously, than what's going on in Afghanistan. I do think that Afghanistan can be salvaged. You know, I don't think that they're beyond saving, but they have to see. And again, I go back to, we've set the example that, you know, we will, you know, you work with us, and then after a while, we're going to leave you on your own. You know, we're just going to leave you at the beach. We're going to leave you at the movies. We're going to leave you at the pool, whatever you want to say. You know, and that sets a very... It makes it hard for you to have allies. It really does. I'd like to hear Rich's input on this. He's on here. I don't know if he can hear or what.
Yeah, well,
haven't
he
heard
said
him. No, I've been listening to you guys.
Oh, gosh. I didn't know he was even on there, man.
Yeah.
Go ahead,
no,
Rich.
No, you guys have been talking pretty well among yourselves, okay?
Yeah.
All right. Really, there's a lot to cover here. First of all, America, all right, this is unconventional warfare. And let's just start with Afghanistan. It's not a country in any remote resemblance to anything we identify in our Western culture as a country. You go to the Middle East, you go to Africa, they have just the Europeans drew boundaries to minimize certain tribes and give other tribes a majority, okay? Afghanistan is not a country. what we think of as like a common language, a common culture, a common ethnic identity. There are 45 different languages spoke in Afghanistan, and the two most prominent is Dari and Pashto, okay? But they identify as tribes, by their tribes, in the rural areas. But you could also say that where it comes to the people living in the cities, well, they're more secular, so they don't identify as the tribes. So it's very, very complex. And the problem we had in Afghanistan is, well, let me back up. Okay, so you mentioned, you try to compare it with Iraq. Well, they speak one language, all right? But there's three ethnic identities, Sunni, Shia, and Kurds. That's it, okay? That's pretty simple compared to Afghanistan.
Oh.
So we go, all right, now, Afghanistan was a country. It's not even a country. It's a border. A border state. Okay. Russia and England agreed on this boundary of this country that we call Afghanistan as a buffer between, you know, Russian control and India. That's it. They wanted a buffer state. That's all it was. And they just lump all these people, have no singular identity. Okay. Go in and try to create a solution that would fit maybe in Iraq or some other place that has some kind of, maybe some diversity, like maybe two or three tribes, but not something as complex as Iraq, as Afghanistan. And so, the first mistake is they identify by tribe. So we're creating a, we're going to, this is what we did. We went in, or okay, let me give you a quick overview of the war in Afghanistan. And the author of that article, I believe, is wrong. I don't think he knew. I think he had his head up his ass, all right, when he was writing it. Okay, because he's looking at it from a European perspective, a Western perspective. Okay, so we go in there to take down the Taliban and take out al-Qaeda. And for the next 4 years, that is our focus. So from 2001 till, actually I say five, 2006, we're basically hunting down al-Qaeda. We let bin Laden slip through our fingers and stuff like that in the mountains of Tora Bora and all that. He goes into Pakistan. And so we continue this counterterrorism. And in 2006, we doubled the number. It's only one brigade. The Bush administration understood the lesson. Well, I'm going to say the Bush. It's the military. The military said, keep the footprint small. Keep the footprint small. Let's not let what happened to Russia happen to us. And that goes until about 2006. They doubled the number of brigades in there. And, you know, for me as the transportation corps historian, that's significant because you doubled the number of brigades, but you didn't double the number of aviation assets because everything was going in by air and going out by air. All these combat outposts were delivered by helicopter. Now you got to start delivering by ground, okay, ground convoys. Okay, so 2006. And during that period of expansion, we go from, by the time my first trip over there was 2008, I think we had three brigades. We finally brought a third brigade in. And we were expanding. The British came in. I think they also came in 2006, and they wanted the Helmand province, which is Taliban control. Okay, they wanted to flex their muscles down there with their Australian counterparts and a lot of other countries. Okay, so that was, they carved that area out. We were based, the rest of NATO was looking at the northern and western area, and they were all into nation building, but it is, It is United States focused on the east, the border area with Pakistan, and we're trying to contain the foreign guerrillas coming in and stuff like that. Okay, and then comes McChrystal. Right now, between that time, 2006 to 2010. The one part in that article is correct, is a lack of a coherent strategy or policy. And that was it. Everybody was signed their AO. And how you fight guerrilla wars, look at Vietnam, look at Iraq, look at Afghanistan. You slice up the pie, and you give a commander responsibility for his slice of the pie and tell, take care of it, okay? Vietnam was divided into four core areas, you know, I Corps up in the north, two corps, three corps was around Saigon, and four corps was Mekong Delta. Iraq was divided into multinational divisions, and Afghanistan was divided into regional commands, RCs. Okay, so slice up the pie. But when McChrystal came in, and he has – now, when I say he had, I got in this debate with someone, and like, well, he's a special forces guy. Yeah, let me tell you. I forgot the year. I was in 7th ID when SF became a branch, and I had my fears about it. See, before special forces became a branch, what kind of officer wanted to go special forces? Because I'm going to tell you right now, post-Vietnam, it was career suicide. If you went special forces as an officer, you were committing career suicide. And to illustrate that, as a lieutenant, you know, 8th Infantry Division in Germany, 80 to December 82, when the word, you see, everybody knew I had served in an SF unit as an enlisted man. And they're like, okay, that explains why he's crazy, but he's got that behind him because he's a West Point graduate. When they found out I plan to go back, seriously, I'm not making this up. All the West Point graduates in my battalion sat my ass down on a cot. We were a bomb holder, and tried to talk me out of it. And the funniest thing, you know, they come up with all kinds of things like, "Don't you ever," because knowing. It's understood. You go SF, you ain't making lieutenant colonel. You'll be lucky to retire as a major. And they're going like, you ever expect, you know, make lieutenant colonel, whatever? It's, hell, I don't, after what I've seen this Harry today, I don't even want to make captain. And finally goes, so why you want to go to special forces? I said, because I want to have fun. And he looks at me, he goes, because the cost of the West Point education at that time was $150,000. He said, this Army didn't pay $150,000 for you to have fun. Like, the logic of that comment right there just reaffirmed why I was going Special Forces. Well, anyway, but that's how it was. And so one of the reasons they created Special Forces as a branch is so that you could now make it to general officer. But my fear was this, because during that time frame, what kind of officer was going to go Special Force? Well, the guy who's like, you know, I like playing Army, but I don't like this conventional crap. I'm going to go into the Special Forces community because they're different. And keep in mind, you got the World War II guys, and that is, you can't train someone to think unconventional. They're either unconventional or they're not. Now, you can take an unconventional guy and train him to think better. And we had a lot of guys that did not fit in the conventional environment because they were different. They came over here and they found hope. And we also had the Walter Mitty types. The guys who wanted to look the part, wear the beret, most of them were big into guns and stuff. But guess what? The only time they deployed downrange is if the battalion commander was deploying downrange. The rest of us were doing all the missions. So why I bring that up is because the bread and butter of Special Forces was training either guerrillas or training host nation forces. In this other category we call direct action or strike missions was kicking in doors. that was not our bread and butter. You know, my time in seventh group in the 80s was training El Sals and a bunch of other missions, okay, and the Caribbean islands. And what I feared is that when it became a branch, now all of a sudden careers are coming into it. Guys not interested in doing missions, but guys interested in being elite and moving up. McChrystal was in the counterterrorist. He was very good at the counterterrorist role. And when he took command of ISAF in 2010, he correctly identified this lack of coherent strategy. And he realized, in some areas, you had battalion commanders who realized that they are now fighting a counterinsurgency. This is not a counterterrorism war. The special forces was into hunting down high priority targets, but these battalions, these infantry battalions, like your, Father Michael, your son's battalion commander, were in the coin business, counterinsurgency, and so McChrystal codified a counterinsurgency strategy. And he's also the first general to get up there and say, we could actually win this. A surge of troops, and Obama was only into a temporary surge of troops. And I already knew that was wrong. And I'm going, you're surging into an area you don't even control. And then you're going to end up leaving it. You're going to have people, you know, like the Korngal Valley and Korngal Outpost Cop, which was like, it was a training ground for the Taliban and the international terrorists, okay? And you're going to end up giving up that ground anyway. And it was really Petraeus. Because there's no book. The book written by Petraeus was mostly about his Iraq experience, but not – he replaces McChrystal after he gets canned.
Right.
And Petraeus really did not, in recent interviews, he said, there's no victory. Victory in the idea that we have is, you know, we defeat the Taliban and all of a sudden we have a country that is secure. No, it ain't going to happen that way. Here's my solution, and I've always advocated this. Let the Taliban have ground, okay? You know, let's come to an agreement. Whatever you control right now, that's yours. Okay. And the reason I believe we need to do that, because we got to give them something to lose. Let the Taliban create a government. Okay. That way, if while we're building up the other, you know, the rest of the country, okay, because I can't say the Afghan government, because there's no such thing as an Afghan government. You know, that's the other thing we're missing, corruption.
Hmm.
The rest of the world, the rest of the world's governments are corrupt, except a lot of Europe, but even like Greece and a lot of these other countries, they're corrupt. We have corruption. Yes, we definitely have corruption, but not on the scale of these other European countries. And the thing is, we're trying to create a non-corrupt, working in non-corrupt environment. We're trying to in place a government that is identical to ours, and it ain't going to happen. They're not in those kind of cultures. It's all about corruption. So here's the problem. So we create a national army, an Afghan army, ANA, an Afghan army, in a tribal environment. And we're going to have people who don't belong to those tribes. Let me start with this. And we're going to disarm those tribes. We're going to say, trust the government. Give us your gun. Give us all your AK-47. The very thing that makes you identifies you as a man is your ability to protect your community. We're going to disarm you, and we're going to bring in this idea that we're going to create a national army that has no tribal identity, and we're going to protect you. They have no investment in that province. Okay, I'm going to tell you this. From what I'm reading between the lines, there are two reasons the ANA and the ANP, the Afghan National Police, is collapsing and falling back. First one, corruption. They're not getting paid. They're not getting supported. They're not getting what they need to fight. Second thing is they have no identity with the people they were assigned to protect, okay? Now, in 2010 or 11, they started the village defense concept based on CIDG program, which is what we did with a lot of villages, but most successful with the Montagnards. And when you mentioned about abandoning the Montagnards, I want to tell you something. The Montagnards kept fighting 10 years after Saigon fell. That's how successful Special Forces mission was. And that is what we should have really been focusing on in Iraq, okay, in Afghanistan. But we tried to take we didn't understand. Our military leaders, senior military leaders, did not understand the problem. And they came up with we keep coming up with a cookie-cutter solution that we think will – it worked with America. It will work throughout the rest of the world. I'm like, no, it won't. We had to accept the reality of corruption. And here's something. Okay, you want to know why this army was holding together while Americans were there? Because the Americans were going in when they were here and the army wasn't getting paid. They're going in and they're like kicking somebody's ass. It wasn't necessarily the American army there ready to fight. It was the American army, which was, you know, we were there to make sure the Afghan soldier was taken care of. As long as he was getting his three hots and a cot and his pay, you know, he's going to fight. Let me tell you something about the Panamanian army. That's one of my wars. The moment their pay stopped, that army folded. But it's interesting how paramilitary, you know, who are not being paid, will continue to fight. But for the professional soldier, when you're not meeting your agreement with him to pay him and feed him and provide him the tools he needs, the resources he needs to fight, he's going to stack arms and leave. And that is what I'm hearing is happening in Afghanistan. So I render the rest of my time.
Yeah.
Okay.
I want to be fair to the author, and I know my son has even communicated with him, and I think he'd be more than willing to share with us if that were necessary. But I would like to read, if it's okay, James, just another – I don't want to take anything out of context, but I want to hear Rich's rebuttal or comments and yours as well, if I can just read another paragraph from this article in The Atlantic.
Sure, go ahead.
He says – over these past 20 years, there have been many failings. We checked the box when it came to saying that we had trained our partners, spun a rosy narrative of progress, and perhaps prioritized the safety and well-being of our troops over the mission of buttressing partner capacities. In parentheses, it says, when our Afghan partners shot at us, killing our comrades, in the now infamous, quote, green on blue, end quote, incidents, we tightened up our security procedures but didn't address the hard questions of why they were shooting at us in the first place. We didn't send the right people, prepare them well, or reward them afterward. We rotated strangers on tours of up to a year and expected them to build relationships, then replace them. We were overly optimistic and largely made things up as we went along. We didn't like oversight or from Washington, and no one really bothered to hold us accountable anyway. We had no capacity or experience with some of our tasks, and we stumbled. Yet these failings, egregious as they were, made it easy to focus on the armed forces as a scapegoat. In fact, the military, our allies, and our Iraqi and Afghan partners were responding to a lack of coherent policy and strategy. There's more, but I would be interested, Rich and James, in your thoughts on that. And like I said, I don't want to take Colonel Jason's article anything out of context. I know he'd be willing to talk with us, but these are some pretty important things that he's pointing out that I think we need to discuss.
Well, I mean, I'll try to get this going, and then, of course, I want Rich's input on this. But so I agree with a lot of what he's saying. I do, you know, of course, I see it not from – so Rich is an operator. So for those of you who don't know that, he is a special forces operator. He is highly respected in that field. And so I do agree with him.
All right, James, don't exaggerate. I was SF, but I'm not highly respected, okay?
Well, I would just say this, that I have a YouTube channel that you are on, and that there were individuals that came on there and commented and said that exact same thing. I'll show you the comments. So maybe it's somebody you served with, or maybe somebody you paid to say that. I don't know. But but
we respect you.
So anyway,
don't exaggerate.
So obviously, you know, Rich has his view on this. My view on this is that coming from someone that was at a company grade level, that you know, that saw, you know, many operations that were done well and many that were not done so well, none in Afghanistan, all of them in Iraq. For me, let me tell you where I really believe the breakdown is exactly what I told y'all earlier. And it is the political jockeying about this tragedy.
Yeah.
This tragedy. And let me tell you, it is a tragedy. And both sides, I'm telling you, the American people, if they should get upset, it shouldn't be upset at the troops, but ultimately they will pay the price for it, because we've never learned to hold the right people accountable, which is every single one of those people that have been elected, Republican, Democrat, down the line. You should not vote for any of those people, you know what I mean, because they have made a pig's ear of this thing. And ultimately, people will say, well, you know, they're not the troops on the ground, but they're the ones that are making the decisions. They're the ones that are pulling the strings or cutting the deals. And now they're the ones that are, what I feel, they are going to create a they're going to throw blood in the water so that they can get Democrats and Republicans fighting, so that they can blame each other. And the people that make the biggest stink, you know, essentially will encourage the people of America to vote the way that they want to vote, because we're suckers for that. Now, that's my opinion. Now, the troops, they won every battle that they fought. They have performed heroically. They should be welcomed home as heroes. And, you know, I look at this that, you know, the Afghan people have had 20 years of us being in there, whether that be good 20 good years or 20 bad years. But it should have been enough for them to have been able to have figured something out, you know, on their own. And that's my opinion on that. So,
well, that's where we differ, all right?
Yeah.
You had a corrupt government, all right? And look, now I'm just repeating myself. You had a corrupt government. That was our failing. We should have focused on the tribes defending themselves. That's what I really believe. We should have brokered a deal with the Taliban. Here's your part of the government. If at any, create a government, all right? Show us what you can do. And if you piss us off at any time, guess what? We're going to attack you, okay? We're going to destroy your government, and then you're going to get to rebuild it again. You got to give them something to take away. But this idea of creating a Kabul government that's going to rule the country, that ain't happening, all right? That's a pipe dream. Okay. Green on blue. All right.
Yeah, I want to hear about that.
Go back. If you haven't watched John Wayne and the Green Berets, go back and watch it.
Brad.
Say again?
I used to run the loop at Bragg where they made the movie, but I've seen
it. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I was signed to Okinawa where some of the scenes were filmed, and then, of course, at Benning when I went through the school for little boys, Yeah, we went to Pagoda Hill. We trained on Pagoda Hill, where the base camp was. Okay, but everything, what was left of the ruins of the pagoda, everybody, locals took as souvenirs. So there's nothing left. So we had the trench system. But anyway, there's a scene in there where the Arvin captain comes in, and Beckwith is the reporter, and they give the report and say they talk about BC ladder stuff like that, and Beckwith goes, "This is all new to me," and he says, "Are the VC that close?" And the captain looks at him and goes, "Mr. Beckwith, I have VC in my own stripes purse." That was known. The enemy is infiltrating your ranks. They're enlisting in your ranks. We knew that training El Sals. In fact, we had an incident where one of the El Sals stole one of our 45s. And it was hard to, that was one of the other companies, and the guys were complaining about they had a hard time sleeping that night listening to that guy get beat the shit out of him, okay, as they were forcefully interrogating him, okay? So green and blue, the bad guys are in your ranks.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of unconventional warfare. Okay, it hasn't changed and it doesn't change. All right, political resolve. Okay, soldiers, look, the American Army can beat anybody. We can solve any problem we're given. It comes down to political resolve. Okay, so why did Saigon fall in 75? Because the Arvin was incapable of defending itself? No. Congress cut them off. They ran out of ammo. We didn't resupply them. Okay?
Right.
We literally cut that army off. We left it out to dry. That army could have defended itself. Okay? So, and here we are. Why could the Afghan army? What changed? Why is it this is the question everybody's going to be asking. Why is it, as long as that American brigade was in country, an American brigade, a single brigade is in country, is the Afghan army able to not just hold ground, but gain ground against the Taliban? And then you start pulling it out, everything falls apart. Go back to what I said about corruption.
Mm-hmm.
We're the one making sure that army functions. We needed to be there to make sure that army functioned. But we pulled them out. And, all right, if you listen to the news, it's, look, this is occurring during Biden's watch. But the deal to pull out was, I believe Biden was pulled out anyway, okay? But Trump's the one who brokered the deal to pull out in May, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I disagree on Trump on banning the Kurds in Syria, and I disagree with him on pulling out Afghanistan, because he was a businessman, and he looks at, what is it, cost-benefit
fiscal
analysis. So for him, it's like, what are we getting out of the money we're investing in this country? Prestige, national security, global stability, all that stuff means nothing to him because he's a businessman. All right. So Biden comes along. Now, Biden has no problem, reversing any policy Trump came up with except pulling out of Afghanistan. So he owns this one. And most senior military leaders are saying pulling out was a bad idea. Okay. And so we're left with the fact that really the question is how bad is it going to get? I think the army will defend the cities as much as they can. But it'll find, first of all, there's certain areas that here it's going to fall back to the way it was when we went in there in 2001. Warlords. It's going to get, that's what we should have built this country around, was warlords. But oh no, we love democracy. You know, democracy has failed probably as much as it has succeeded. All right, this experiment. Look, you don't know what the second big experiment in democracy was after the American Revolution? It was called the French Revolution. Okay, we know how that mm-hmm. turned out. Okay,
yeah, really.
So yeah, this is a lack of political resolve. All we had to do, and I'm going to tell you right now, less than 1% of Americans serve in the military. And I'm going to tell you right now, the rest of the 99% of this America doesn't fucking count. Okay? I'm telling you right now that soldiers are enlisting to go to war. They want to go to Iraq. They want to prove themselves. All right? The only people who've lost resolve is people like Biden. And the rest of these politicians and Trump, okay? Americans want to go to war. We are warrior people. I've been wanting to have a show about why we're willing to fight and die for other countries.
Mm.
And it isn't because we care about their freedom. It's a good excuse because we really want to kick somebody's ass. And I'm telling you right now, we would not have problems with enlistment knowing that we're going to send a brigade worth of guys to Afghanistan every year. I'm telling you right now, when I graduated West Point, you want to know what the number one assignment pick for assignment was? Korea. Because mm-hmm. the DMZ was the closest place you can get combat experience. America. Okay, less than 1% of this nation wants to go kick somebody's ass. And they don't care who. They're looking for a good excuse. And Biden and Trump had no. So Trump looked at it as a businessman. Biden has no balls. So I turn the floor.
There's another related article to this, and I haven't read it, but I'm just curious as to what you both think about the ramifications here. It says how the Afghan withdrawal cost the U.S. with China. I'm just wondering, you know, what the other ramifications are. You know, we're looking at this article as people who were in the military as professionals mm-hmm. that want to do an AAR. And, you know, we want to understand some of the ramifications for those that follow after us, and especially James's mm-hmm. position right now as the commander at the Purple Heart organization.
Well,
but mm-hmm. there's a lot of ramifications that we need to consider as we advise. You know, one of the things that he said, we didn't like oversight or tough questions from Washington, and no one really bothered to hold us accountable anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That's really problematic for me, one who's taught ethics in the
military. Pacelli, come on, guys. There is a commander appointed in charge of Afghanistan. He is responsible for that. He comes up with a strategy to win. He passes up. You know, when you're talking about no one holding anyone accountable, explain that. I'd like to hear him defend that. Okay?
Well, I'm sure that
each commander of ISAF was given responsibility for that operation. Now, prior to McChrystal, no one had come up with a counterinsurgency strategy. But McChrystal's counterinsurgency strategy was flawed and way too ambitious, okay? And no one saw it the way I saw it. Well, maybe some did, but they weren't explaining it. But there was central oversight, okay? And, you know, the president, you know, says, here, fix this problem. It goes down the chain of command till it gets to that company commander on the ground. Fix the problem. Here's how you have to do it. Okay.
So let's this is an elephant, so let's eat it one bite at a time. Let's go back to
right.
you know, some of the comments that you made. You know, number one, you know, it's ironic that both presidents wanted out of Afghanistan, but one is because he thought it was, you know, is because of a wise business decision. The other one had no balls. You know, the truth of the matter is neither one of them had any balls. If they truly did, then they would have done what was needed during both of their administrations in order to achieve total victory, or made the conscious decision to depart, but depart on our terms. Now, both of them failed in that mission. This is where I say the politicians, it's not mm-hmm. the troops, it's the politicians that are failing you people. It's the 90% of American people are being failed by 10% of a class of people that have, you know, got themselves in positions that make all the decisions for us. And I'm not saying that we need to, you know, change our leadership style. Look, we have a democratic republic, what we have, whether people right. like it or not. Ben Franklin made that statement very well when he was leaving. And he said, you know, it's a republic if you can keep it. And we have to be able to keep that. And the only way we keep it is if we hold our elected officials accountable. We're not doing that as an American people. We should be livid about what's going on right now, livid to the point to where we have committed. I don't care if you're a Republican. Now, the problem is people are so polarized, you know, politically, I've got to vote for nothing but Democrats, or I got to vote for nothing but Republicans. So you're both wrong. What you need to vote for is competent people that you give them a chance, one chance, one chance. You get 2 years, Congressman, and if you don't do something in 2 years, I don't care about who's in charge. If you're not making noise, rattling sabers, doing something, speaking for the people that you represent, and that includes people that didn't vote for you, then you should be removed from that position. And how you remove them is through the electoral process. The greatest way of changing government is here in America every 2 to 4 years. We can do that. So yeah. I just wanted to set that tone. The other thing is I agree.
All right. Let me interject real quick. So you're basically saying vote for Belinda Fox Spencer?
What I'm saying is
that
what
yeah,
you,
James. All right.
Well, you know, now what I'm saying is that you should
vote. Vote them out.
You should
bring
vote
in
out.
The
bad.
Well, bring in the well, independents.
You know, I don't
all
care.
Right, anyway, move on to
Democrat,
your next
Republican.
Topic. Okay, I've probably gotten you in enough trouble as it is.
Yeah. Well. So you know what we need to look at is we need to look at the people that are running. That's the deal, okay? And stop looking at the political party. And then, you know, let me tell you, it's a failure in a political process that's got us in this mess. The
and
other thing...
I'm sorry, James. I just want to say what he states in the article is mm-hmm. instead of leaving the entire effort to the Department of Defense, a coordinated
yes.
strategy with commensurate resources across government could have
mm-hmm.
produced better results in multiple Afghan institutions. So,
I agree.
You know,
starting with education
on both parts.
Mm-hmm. Starting with education,
mm-hmm.
we should have been educating the kids who would have been, you know, 8-10 years old when we first got there. They would be
right.
the leaders today, and you
mm-hmm.
educate them on ethical decisions that are
right.
made by people with a sound mind. And
mm-hmm.
you do that through a level of education. I mean, let me tell you, basic education would probably fix 90% of the problems in America and the world. And people say, what do you mean? Yes, people are educated in America, but we're not educated in all the right things. It's not just math,
right.
science, and history, but there's also an ethical piece. If we
That's
taught
right.
ethics, if we taught civics in school like we should, then I'm telling you, we would have a better society. We really would. They used to teach it.
No, James, I disagree with you. We need to teach critical race theory. Screw civics. No one needs to know how the government works. Need to know that if you're white, you're a racist. If you're black and if you're a person of color, you're a victim. That's what we need to teach everybody.
No, we don't. No, listen, that we've already had that discussion. I'm trying to have a serious discussion about the education. Now, what Father Michael is
saying.
I'm saying
that's an excellent idea. That's where you have to start. I mean, even when I was a kid, the Catholics would say, you give me a kid, you know, at 7 years old, you know, and we'll make him a Catholic for the rest of his life. And the catechesis, the training, the memorization. I'm not saying it was brainwashing, whatever, but it was education in ethics, just like you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other thing too is, you know, we should have been training people in business and how to establish legitimate businesses and you know, and building on the resources. I met a lady and her husband up in New York a few years ago. Wonderful people. And they were working with women and girls of Afghanistan, and they had these wonderful skills. They had these wonderful skills for, you know, arts and craft and creating clothing and different things, like beautiful, beautiful items. And she was trying to bring them to New York to teach them how to become, you know, manufacturing business owners back in Afghanistan and setting them up to sell product. And it wasn't like weapons or anything like that. It was like hats, gloves, scarves, things of that culture. And we should have done more of that. We always think about, you know, the weapons and the kill. Like Rich said, I mean, what Rich said is true. A lot of people join the military and they just sit around and they dream about going to war, and everybody thinks that they're going to go and they're going to, you know, they're going to take the bunkers and they're going to win the medals and they're going to come home and be, you know, welcomed with open arms. Most of them are disappointed when they find out that warfare, you know, is a lot
of sitting around.
90% sitting around, followed by 10% of, you know,
absolutely.
Oh my God, you know, right. You don't know what's going to happen. And in some cases, some experience a little less and some experience a lot more. But
hey, look, I've been in four wars and I have not experienced what you experience in 45 minutes on a wall at BIOP, okay? I have never heard rounds, you know, I believe if there's a bullet that has your name on it, it's going to find you. But it's all those for whom they may concern that work in me. Okay.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's, well, a few of them did find me, but they didn't find me in the right places. But,
amen.
You know,
they just reached out and touched you. Okay.
So I will
Jim,
tell you.
Can
as,
we just pick that up again about the business? Because a friend of mine, Dr. John Stenko, was teaching at the University of Kabul. During the war, very secular stuff about purpose. He's gone to other countries, Africa, where he's taught people how to start businesses or other organizations that do that. I think that we really need to, as we're doing this after action report, to say what we need to do for the future. And I think you need to pick up a little more about teaching children ethics who will be leaders of tomorrow. And also teaching people business. Now, I know that just because we go to Africa and give them glasses and American clothing, that doesn't mean we're bringing the gospel to them. Matter of fact, the mission itself is corrupting their own culture. But here we're trying to help you. My son told me, he said it was like living in the Bible days. You know, that's how backward. Now, you're not going to change them and build skyscrapers, and I've never been to any of their large cities, but I know when I went to Hong Kong during Vietnam, I was surprised in how developed it was. But I think, James, we really need to strategically talk about these important things so that we do leave, we at least have left a worthwhile contribution.
Well, you think about this, Father Michael. You think about what if we would have invested one-tenth of what we've invested in weapons and things that the Taliban is taking. And we would have invested that money instead in developing businesses and saying, look, you stop killing each other, okay,
right,
and we'll start buying your product. I would much rather have spent money.
All right,
on
let me talk about reality, guys. Okay, that's a nice dream world.
It really occurred. Let me
tell you a funny story. Okay, so this guy was taking a class. I can't remember what it is, politics, whatever. All right, so they, so what they did is they broke them down into groups. They said, you guys are on these separate islands, and we're going to see who can create the best plan for prosperity, okay? So each one of them started working on some kind of, I'm not making this up. The guy, I'm on a van pull. The guy was riding my van. He told me about it. So he said, all these other groups, they're working on business and stuff like that. And the group he was in, for some reason, all the military, you know, I don't know what it is about military people always tend to, you know, gravitate towards each other. So while everybody else is working on all these business ideas, like what you just talked about, if we could just teach how people how to be business savvy and give a market, you know, they will not want to kill each other. So meanwhile, this whole group started building weapons and boats to invade the other islands. And they went and conquered the other islands. The old saying that those who pound their swords into plowshare will be plowing for those who don't, that's the reality. I'm telling you right now, before you can have any kind of prosperity, you have to have security. We should have been focusing on training those tribes, not a nation. There's no such as an Afghan nation. We should have been focusing on training the tribes to defend themselves. And after they can defend themselves, then we can build prosperity.
Well, we had 20 years to do it, and obviously we didn't make
accomplishments. No, this could last 40 years.
Well,
all we have to do is keep
at some point,
small presence there.
Hey, let me tell you, at some point, the American people should demand an exit strategy. I mean, look, here's the deal. We cannot go.
What was our exit, James, what was our exit strategy from Korea? There was no end to the war. What was our exit strategy from the Korean War?
Well,
we're still there.
Over 50 years, we're still there.
70 years.
We're still there.
Korea and Afghanistan are two different countries, and one's much smaller than the other. And the number of resources needed.
All right.
Yeah.
Here's my reason. I'm going to tell you like why we needed to keep at least a battalion, if not a brigade, in there. Combat training. We need. I believe this is the way I look at it. We need a small conflict where we can rotate soldiers through to get combat experience. This nation, all right, I'm going to tell you, the majority of our country is woke, but there's still enough, there's 1% of this, of our population that's ready to kick somebody's ass, anybody's ass, and we need a combat training area for them. See, when you look at other countries, well, no one goes to war on the frequency and scale as the United States does.
Well, most of them, number one, Rich, most of them that talk all that big shit about wanting to kick somebody's ass will not join the Army and will not go to war. But listen to me. The people like myself and the people in the organization that I represent, we would prefer not to have any more members. We would prefer that no one else gets wounded or killed. Now, I'm just telling you.
Yeah, I know. James,
we're 49,000
strong. I grew up in the shadow of the old West.
Yeah.
I grew up in the shadow of the West, and I studied the Native American culture. And I remember the Indian councils as they talk about the war council.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so here's all the elders, the old warriors. You don't get to be an old warrior without being a young warrior. So the old warriors, They're the ones who are advising. You don't want to go to war. You don't want to experience what we did. But the problem is the Native American culture is a warrior culture. And if you're a young man, you can't even get married if you're not a warrior, if you haven't counted to. You have to prove yourself. Got all these young warriors going, I want to be the old guy sitting in the council advising against going to war, but I got to go to war to experience that. Okay? So there you are, all you guys that got wounded. Yeah, I got it. But I'm telling you right now, we've got enough people wanting to join the Army. The reason, see, we don't fight on our home soil. We fight on other people's ground. Why? Because we've got people who don't care the reason why. Actually, that's one thing I want to address before we hang up, okay? All right, which is, okay, so as you watch Afghanistan fall, you shouldn't feel any remorse for it. I think we should change the subject to that because I've listened to the Vietnam vets describe what it was like to see Saigon fall, what it was like to see that helicopter off from the U.S. Embassy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Afghanistan, look, to me, Afghanistan was one of the best combat operations we had. And I'll tell you why. Because when I joined 1st Special Forces Group on Okinawa in 1973, the guys I served with, they had never gone home. Seriously. They were repeat offenders. They had multiple tours in Vietnam. And everybody is like, to be a Green Beret, you had to have a jump boots, Green Beret, and a Rolex watch and a Black Star Sapphire ring, okay? And it's kind of like, they're all mercenaries. It's like, I got to where, as I'm growing up and I'm learning from these guys, is I learned to evaluate our wars on the quality of the shopping. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to Colombia, El Salvador, Panama, Honduras, and all, Iraq, Kuwait. If they mine gemstones from there, you can get handmade rugs cheap, okay? That's the war we should have stayed in, okay? I was disappointed when they pulled the plug on my last – did two trips over there. I was disappointed when they pulled the plug on my last trip because I had a long shopping list. Okay, now – when I was in first group, there was a saying about Vietnam. It ain't much of a war, but it's the only one we've got. The thing is, you can't, as you look at it and you go, I risk all this for that country. No, here's what I'm going to say. The vast majority of Americans who serve in the military are serving because they had a close personal relative who had served, okay? A father, mother, uncle, grandfather, whatever, who had served. And I'll bet you, unless you're an immigrant, that you can probably trace that back. Someone has served in almost every conflict back to the Civil War, okay? Because that is part of our culture. You serve out of a family tradition of service.
Right.
Okay. Like I say, we go to war on a large scale every generation because we have a new generation waiting to be blooded in combat. And they don't care who we're going to fight. They want to trust their political leaders for this idea that, okay, I went down to liberate Panama. All right, great. I'm married to a Panamanian, okay? I have relatives down there. They didn't like Noriega, okay, because I was married to someone from the middle and upper class. Yeah, they didn't like Noriega. Had I married someone from the lower class, they might have been pissed, okay? But here's the deal. It doesn't matter the outcome. We give these countries their freedom, and they screw it up. That's not our fault.
Rich, I'm a military historian. Issue about being realistic. I think some of what James and I are saying about being realistic. I think that
being
we understand anthropologically that we're fallen and that no matter what you try to design, people are going to mess it up. That's just
there you go. That's it.
But I don't think we shouldn't try, like James was saying, trying to teach children, trying to teach people that there's a better way, you know, and even if it is economically, so that you can build up your country and you can sell your goods, share your heritage, your culture, whatever it might be. Because, I mean, the wounds that people have, you know, I have counseled a lot of women who've had abortions. No one listens to those confessions. And the same with a lot of warriors. Yeah, there's the bludgeoning, there's the, you know, the courage, but there's also a lot of demons and a lot of things that they're living with the rest of their lives. And as James said, we don't want any other people having to join this organization. So, yeah, I have a realistic view of, you know, anthropology, the limits of what good people can do. But I don't think we should throw the baby out the bathwater. I think that we should try some more positive approaches as we invest so much money.
Agreed. Agreed. Father Michael.
I think the main thing is like, don't judge the outcome by the effort that you put into it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the fact is, this country didn't fall apart until Biden pulled us out. And as long as we had stayed there, this country could have helped. What we did there, everybody should be proud of.
Well, and see, and that's not entirely true. That country was a train wreck before we got there. That country has been a train wreck since we've been there. That country has had people that have been murdered. You've had corruption. Nothing's changed. You know, blaming it and seeing that's inherent. What you just said is the problem right there, blaming it on one political faction instead of doing the right thing and blaming it on both. I'm with Father Michael on this. I think that we should, if we're going into these countries, and we really shouldn't be into nation building, we're not supposed to be, but if we go into these countries that have nothing, no established infrastructure, then we need to work on that infrastructure. Look, we fixed the water system in Iraq. That was there's a big story about that. Scam and the water system. And we helped the kids go to school. You know, education. I'm telling you right now, what those two people were doing in New York with those girls from Afghanistan could have been duplicated and could have been successful, more successful than what it was. Yeah. It was successful for a short period of time. And ethics, you know, strange is to us is, you know, I have kids that I don't, you know, my kids don't steal. You know, they don't steal because they were taught not to steal.
Mm-hmm.
In these countries, they're encouraged to steal. Some people will say, well, that's because they have to survive. Well, I hear you, but there's a better way of doing things. There has to be a level of ethical education and morality that starts with the troops on the ground. And, Rich, you know, you and I have had this discussion. You know, my soldiers that work for me, if I caught them abusing the Iraqi people, I explained to them, you throw something from your truck and you hit one of those kids. Yeah, you're laughing, you're joking about it, but you've created an entire family, a future enemy that's probably going to try to kill somebody else coming up down the road. And you have to win the hearts and minds of the people. You really do. I really believe that.
You have to understand that soldiers aren't just about killing.
Yeah.
Because that's the concept. Any of us that want to be in the military, you know, that's a part of it. But it's not when my son was told when he was going to Afghanistan, you can kill people. His comment was, I hope not. I mean, that's not like we're looking forward to killing people. No, we're looking forward to bringing peace, to changing a situation, to helping people. And if we have to use force, yes, I'm not a pacifist, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But that should be the last resort. It's not the only thing. Because I had young soldiers, all fair in love and war. No, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be
That's
accountable
right.
to God. You have to have an ethical base. We're not looking for mercenaries. We're mm-hmm. looking for real professionals, as we are on the police force as well. That's why I wrote my book.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that you have to be pacifist.
Yeah, well, and that's the same thing with and I'm glad you brought up the police force too, because you know there's a lot of disgruntled people that you know there are bad soldiers, there are bad police officers, there are bad teachers, bad in everything.
Yep.
But there's right. also great, wonderful ones that mm-hmm. vastly outnumber the bad ones. The problem is we're not holding the right people accountable. Like I said in the beginning, you want to be mad at somebody. We shouldn't be mad just at Biden. We shouldn't be mad at just the Democrats. We need to be upset. And we really shouldn't be mad, but we should, if you're going to be upset with those political leaders that have jockeyed and brokered these deals for the last 20 years. Because now we're leaving this country, and what's what we got to show for it? I mean, really, what do we got to show for it? Other than we killed a lot of bad people.
I know we have about 5 minutes.
All right.
Yeah, we got 5 minutes. Go ahead, Father.
I'll try to say it quick so you guys can rebuttal or whatever. It's a personal thing, all right? I've been in two wars in uniform and two wars without and one coup d'etat. And the outcome, look, I spent 6 months in Honduras, training El Sals and helping their country, and Honduras ended up becoming the murder capital of the world, okay? That's not my fault. And I'm still very happy about that experience I went down there. All right, so for all those veterans out there, like the Vietnam vets, they're now that they're all meet, getting together, the reunions and stuff. It's what you did. It's what you do. You should never, you should never evaluate the outcome on what you put into it. Always be proud of it. Americans are the best. We have the best army in the world. All right, just because we can hand these people and spend 20 years, hand them their freedom and spend 20 years trying to teach them how to hold on to it, and because of inherent problems, they lose it, that is not our fault. The fact is, we went in and kicked the Taliban's ass in a matter of months, and we held them at bay for 20 years. And we can do it again. If we had a president who's going to send us back in there, guess what? We could reverse all those gains again, reverse the gains of the Taliban. There's no country out there that can kick ass like the United States Army, and you should be proud of it.
And I think we're all proud of our service, but I think like the radical Muslims and jihad and holy war, we can't say that everything we've done has been sanctioned by God, and it's right. We're trying to take a critical view. We're trying to do an after-action report. We're so grateful for all of the soldiers, male and female, that sacrificed their lives. But let's be honest with ourselves, just like we're trying to do with the police departments, that we still can improve as individuals, as human beings.
Absolutely, folks, and we've got about a minute left, and I want to thank you all for listening in to another edition of Continue Mission. As you can hear, we have different views. That's the reason why we're on this show together. A lot of times you'll hear what you think is the three of us arguing, but that's not really arguing. We have to present different points of view. So understand that we are all great friends when we leave this radio show as such, and I want you as the American people to always try to remain friendly and decent and civil to one another, and remember, that your most powerful tool in your toolbox is your vote. Don't let nobody take it away from you. You utilize that voting right that you have because it is a right that has been paid for in blood by many, many great, wonderful people, much better people than I. Don't ever give it up. Ensure that you do it every chance you get and do it with the conscious mind that every decision you make has an impact. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. Let's try to make them all good. So, folks, continue us. Come see us again next Friday or listen to us next Friday on Continue Mission. We will be here at 10 o'clock on Friday night, and our show goes till midnight. Call in, and if you have any ideas about a show, you can reach out and let us know at WV Purple Heart 1863@gmail.com. Again, it's WVPurpleHeart1863@gmail.com. God bless each and every one of you. Be good to one another and have a great weekend. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.